The Saturday night special of the Roman world was called a sica. It was a small, curved dagger, sharply honed on both sides, which could be carried hidden in the arm of a toga. And when the Romans conquered Judea in the first century before the Common Era, a number of nice Jewish boys began to carry the sica and to use it. They came to be known as the sicarii, and they were alternately, or so the record seemed to say, the Robin Hoods of the Jewish community, protecting the poor against tax collectors and others who were acting as agents of Roman oppression, and as hoodlums, extortioners, racketeers, murderers, who used the cover of patriotism in order to line their own pockets and to satisfy their own jungle instincts. And there is still a debate, rather serious debate among historians, whether we are to classify the sicarii simply as hoodlums and gangsters who preyed, as all gangsters do, upon the weak and for their own advantage, or whether we should consider them as Jewish patriots, rallying the community to rebel against Rome and attacking those in the community who were quislings, traitors, willing to make peace with Rome for their own advantage. The debate is not settled, and I don't think it ever will be. And if you ever want to know, interestingly, why the man who turns Jesus in to the Romans is called Judas Iscariot, Judah the Sicarii, Judah the gangster, it's simply a pejorative name. Now, gangsters and hoodlums live in a symbiotic relationship to their society. They prey on it, and they are part of it. In the days when gangsters still bestrode the land and were big news, whenever one was finally brought to trial, there were always a procession of little people from their neighborhood who were willing to testify on the good deeds that they had done for them, that is, the kings of the underworld had done against the powers of the overworld in order to protect the weak from city hall or from some kind of oppression. Perhaps the classic example of this is that of Lucky Luciano, the infamous Italian syndicate leader, whom the United States government itself treated with when he was a prisoner in Dannemora, in New York State. The war broke out. It was necessary to be certain of the patriotism and the willingness to work of the longshoremen who were loading the ships, which were carrying the much-needed goods to England and to the Allies. And so members of the United States government went to the prison to deal with Luciano to get his agreement that he would see to it, in his own way, that the longshoremen would work and work with a will. And interestingly, they went back to the prison several years later again to treat with this overlord of the underworld, because we were about to invade Sicily. And they wanted to make sure that we would have the full support of the Sicilian mafia when the Allied troops landed. And we were given that support. And that support saved many an American soldier's life. What I'm saying is simply this: that no one is unidimensional. None of us are so saintly as to be angelic. Kinein adam asher lo yechata, the Bible says, there's no man so righteous that he sins not. And obviously there is no one so evil that he doesn't have an occasional gentle side to his nature, that he does not need some support, some feeling of being worthwhile. And so the gangsters and the hoodlums and the racketeers of the world have always tried to play the role of Robin Hood, because it satisfies their ego and justifies their existence. Now, in this light, in the simple fact that none of us is unidimensional, It seems strange, passing strange to me, that we tend to have a rather romantic, unidimensional understanding of Jewish history. It reads something like this. Our people have long been gentle scholars and Jewish mothers, and we have watched with tolerant wisdom and endured with tolerable patience the jungle and violent activities of the world about us, but not had ever participated in them. We endured, we suffered, we watched, we put it down as a goyish business, and certainly no nice Jewish boy would ever be cut off in this kind of activity. And so we have this rather amazing stereotype that we came to this country from a society which was already beginning to disintegrate, and we passed through the worst, most impacted, impoverished settlements, the east side of New York, the south side of Boston, the other immigrant communities, places of poverty, places where without privacy, places of violence, without being touched by them, and we made our way to NYU and CCNY, and from the university to decent, middle-class kind of lives. No one fell by the wayside. No one was tempted to take to the streets. We alone, of all the peoples who have ever passed through any immigration experience, passed through untouched. Golda Meir, you remember, some years ago, played to this stereotype of the Jew when she said, you know, I can forgive the Arabs of everything except the fact that they forced some Jewish boys to kill. Now, the Sicarii were nice Jewish boys. And Golda was prime minister of Israel, centered in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is called Kiryat David, the city of David. And David certainly was a nice Jewish boy. And we tend to think of young David as a sweet, poetic type who played on his harp and who had the kind of voice which could quiet the evil spirits that raged in Saul. And that's certainly one of the legends that's told about David in the Bible. But the emes, the real story, is that David was a professional mercenary. He was the last son of a family which had too many sons, and he hired himself out as a trained killer to the Philistines, the great enemies of Israel. And he was so successful at his profession that he soon bound to him a group of other professional soldiers and became a captain of a troop of mercenaries. And it was this leadership of a troop of mercenaries which allowed him to gain authority in Israel, because he had the only effective military force that could be put into the field. And it was because of his control of this Jansenary group that he was able to capture Jerusalem, which till that time had withstood the attacks of the Hebrews and the Israelites, and make it his capital, his own private domain. So the Sicarii were nice Jewish boys, and David is a nice Jewish boy, and some of you may remember in the 1930s when soon-to-be Governor Thomas Dewey was prosecuting the Lepke syndicate in New York. Lepke was a nice Jewish boy. And this crime syndicate began to go out on a campaign to assassinate all those who might testify against them in court. And we're told that at least 1,000 men, women, were killed by these paid assassins, who came to be known in the press as Murder Incorporated. And I assure you that Murder Incorporated was a group of nice Jewish boys. There wasn't a non-Jew among them, unfortunately. So it's time, I think, for reasons of accuracy, if nothing else, that we began to look at the violent side of our nature, the Jew as gangster, began to break the stereotype. And when we do, and we do so not only because of honesty, because in some ways it's more colorful and more compelling to think of Jewish history as a history of people who have ruffians as well as rabbis, and sometimes rabbis who are ruffians. In our own city, during that period which we recall without pleasure as prohibition, the revenuers raided a home in the 105th Street area, and they found a still, and they brought the owner of the home to court, and he was a rabbi. And there was a rather comic court proceeding which included Eliot Ness and the Talmud, because the rabbi quoted to the judge the fact that he needed fermented wine for a kiddush. How could you have Jewish life without a kiddush? And finally, the judge, in desperation, threw the case out of court and told the revenuers that they had more important business than persecuting a poor rabbi. The only problem is, you know, that's a nice Jewish story. But a few years later, the same Orthodox rabbi was arrested by the customs officers on the docks of New York as part of an international smuggling ring which was bringing in diamonds from Antwerp to the United States. So we have our ruffians, and we have our rabbis who do not live up to their calling. Indeed, when I was of the age when we read Treasure Island, and where there was nothing more exciting than a pirate, I could always, even then, introduce people to some kind of excitement about being Jewish by telling them that Jean Lafitte, the successor to Bluebeard, the great pirate admiral who commanded the pirate's navy at Barataria in Louisiana in the turn of the 19th century, who was a Jew, a nice Jewish boy, who was in fact married to a nice Jewish girl by the name of Levine. And they had nice Jewish children. And the story always ended up nicely in a nice Jewish way, because in the War of 1812, Lafitte was the only man who knew his way through all the bayous of the Delta in Louisiana. The United States government had to treat with him in order to be able to repulse the British attack on New Orleans. And so patriotic and successful was Jean Lafitte and his six brothers, all Jews, all pirates, in the defense of New Orleans. They were mentioned in dispatches by Andrew Jackson, and granted a full and unconditional pardon for their earlier piratical activities. Well, enough to prove the point that it didn't take the Arabs to teach nice Jewish boys to kill, pillory, and murder. In point of fact, it would be inconceivable that Jews would have come from 19th century Eastern Europe, from a society which had already gone through several centuries of disintegration. The shtetl had broken down, its economic base had weakened, the authority of the rabbinate had been weakened by its interest in Kabbalah and mysticism, its unwillingness to face the economic problems of the day, its willingness to throw its authority to the few Jewish privileged and tax the Jewish poor inordinately. There had been the growth of industrialization in the 19th century in Vilna and Warsaw and Lodz, Krakow. There was already a Jewish proletariat. And the Jewish proletariat was not just young, upstanding men and women who were meeting in high-minded cells to write out socialist manifestos, but they included people who had taken to the streets, both men and women, who had fallen by the wayside and were trying to find their way into the new world, a world where the clan society would no longer be the dominant social organism. And obviously, a majority of these people were among those who came to these shores. People came to these shores piecemeal, not as whole families usually. Often the only thing the family back home heard again of the father was a mail letter which included a bill of divorce to the wife. He'd established a new set of relationships here. The Lower East Side of New York, the Lower East Side of any of the immigrant communities were poor. There was no privacy. Children had to go on the street for their play, and on the street they learned many lessons that they would not have learned in their homes. The girls particularly came over here illiterate. The male chauvinism of Jewish life had never been interested in training the girls. If a girl was 10 or 12 and 14, she either had to go to work 10, 12 hours a day in the sweatshops, or somehow to go to school, but she was already way beyond the beginning grades and she did not know her alphabet. And there was always just beyond the confines of the Lower East Side, that golden Medina, that other world, the storefronts, the expensive goods, the sense that there was a great world out there if I could only reach out and you know, become part of it. And crime, like sports, like the performing arts, was obviously one of the ways in which you could reach out to quickly jump over the restrictions of the ghetto and the misunderstandings of your parents, if your parents were there, into the opportunities which the new world offered or should offer. And it's time that we looked at this whole history. It's a fascinating one and an important one. We have to remember that social mobility existed side by side with social pathology. Some of you may remember that about 3 years ago, A History of the Jews of Cleveland was published with much pomp and circumstance. And at the time, I criticized the book from this pulpit as presenting a rather institutional, high-minded view of our Jewish community, one which did not really present a full picture of what had been, and therefore could not be a good base to understand what is today. Well, one of the great problems which faced the immigrant Jewish community was the problem of prostitution. Our stereotype is of the Jewish mother. The Jewish mother came into being in the Lower East Side of New York because she had to use every wile and bit of guile that she had in order to maintain the family, if it could be maintained. The father worked 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, or he peddled and then was away from the home for weeks and months on end. The children couldn't play in the home. Every bit of space was used. They played in the street. In the street there was what streets have always offered in America, all kinds of unwanted ideas and inducements. The Jews who came to America, particularly the women, came here in part because they'd broken with their homes in Europe, but being unskilled and illiterate, the girls had very little opportunity to make their way, and the society had yet did not offer many ways in which women could, in fact, make their ways. And so they came to New York, and there were two choices. Either you could work in the sweatshops and spend your youth, you know, slaving over a machine, or you could wear pretty clothes and be with a fast set and somehow jump over and out of the world of which you were part into the mainstream of American life. And many chose that way. And Jews, uniquely among the ethnic groups, proved to be susceptible to prostitution. So much so that in 1911, an informal but very high-ranking conference was held in London, a conference on the suppression of prostitution among Jewish girls and Jewish women. It was a worldwide problem. There were groups of Jewish prostitutes in Buenos Aires, in Cairo, in London, in Paris, in New York, in Boston. So much that we have very few figures that are accurate, but we do know from Buenos Aires that in 1909, there were 299 brothels in the city, of which 102 were run by Jewish madams, and one half of the prostitutes in those brothels were Jews. Prostitution existed among our people. It existed because of the restlessness, the breaking away, the poverty, the lack of privacy, the desire to be part of a larger society. Yet if you read the history of the Jews of Cleveland, you won't find a single reference to prostitution in our city. And that's hard to believe, because if it is so, we are unique among all Jewish settlements in these United States. When I was a student at the Hebrew Union College, I had a small congregation on weekends in a little town called Danville, Illinois. Danville, Illinois never had more than 60 or 70 Jewish families. But every Yom Kippur, two elderly ladies stayed with me in shul all day. And they spoke with each other endlessly. It was a ritual that had been going on for many years. They were both in their high 80s. One of them was the eldest sister of Lessing Rosenwald, of the Sears Roebuck fame. And the other was the Jewish, retired Jewish madam of the brothel in Danville. If Danville had them, Cleveland had them. Now, if you look at the same history, and you look under crime, you find one long paragraph covering two pages which deals not with adult crime, but deals with juvenile delinquency. And we're told that Jewish newsboys tended to appear in court in the 1890s, 1900s in rather surprising numbers. We're not told why. We're not told that what really at work was a gang war to see who controlled which street corners so that you could peddle the papers for a penny apiece. We're told in the quotation from Rabbi Woolsey about gambling parlors along Woodland Avenue and the fact that they are unfortunately attracting young Jewish boys. And then there's almost a throwaway line which indicates that every year several hundreds Jewish juveniles, boys, appeared in juvenile court for a variety of crimes. And the last line, which follows directly upon that one, is that this was a matter of concern to the Jewish social work professional. And that's where they leave it. Several hundred Jewish boys a year, that is boys 15 years of age and under, are appearing in juvenile court. No attempt to analyze for what were their crimes, what happened to them, how many were repeaters, how many grew up to be the leading citizens of Cleveland, and how many grew up to be the leading Jewish criminals and gangsters and syndicate leaders of Cleveland. They leave it there. Now, obviously, in the Woodland area, in the 105th Street area, there was social pathology. There was poverty. There were broken homes. There were people who were simply abandoned by their parents, particularly by their fathers. There's the spread of orphanages in the 1880s and 1890s, not a matter of chance. There were youngsters without homes, without parents, and some of them were still in Europe, and some of them simply abandoned their children here in the United States. There was violence on the streets. Not a word in this history of the Jews of Cleveland about adult criminals. It's as if there weren't any, when in point of fact, we had some of the most notorious of Jewish syndicate leaders grow out of our own neighborhoods. There's a whole book devoted to the so-called Cleveland Four: Tucker, Rothkopf, Kleinman, and Dalitz. All Jewish boys. A man named Harry Mesnick, who was a reporter for the Plain Dealer years and years ago, wrote this volume. Now these young toughs committed every crime that could be committed on the streets of Cleveland as juveniles. And they came into their adulthood just at the time when America committed that ultimate blunder, which is called Prohibition, when we tried to legislate morality. In 1920, the Volstead Act and Prohibition went into effect. And these gangsters were just emerging out of their adolescence, and they took advantage of a golden opportunity to run the whiskey in from Canada, to run it up from the Gulf, and to sell it to your parents and your grandparents and anybody else who was willing to buy it, which meant to everybody else. And suddenly the hoodlum was no longer a hoodlum. He was somebody that you dealt with, somebody that you helped make rich. And there was something exciting about dealing with the speakeasies and buying the liquor illegally. And the illegality of the whiskey trade made it, of course, greatly rewarding. And these young hoodlums became rich. And they moved from whiskey into labor racketeering. They worked equally for both sides, for employers and for the unions. Whoever would pay them, they were willing to work for, to give muscle to. And then they moved into the other areas of crime. Extortion, gambling. They were skillful men. They bought the gambling casinos. They pushed everybody else out. They went from gambling into real estate. They bought up governments, as they bought up Batista's government in Cuba. And whether you went to Las Vegas or Miami or Havana or La Costa, wherever you went, you were putting money into the coffers of Jewish gangsters. Now, I don't say any of this in a spirit of boosterism. I don't think there's any particular virtue in the fact that we had the Cleveland Four. But there were Jewish gangsters of the same ilk in all the places of major Jewish settlement. New York and Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Cincinnati. Every major Jewish community produced gangsters, hoodlums of this kind. And it would be nice to say that being nice Jewish boys, they left the dirty work to others, but that's also not the case. I remind you of Murder Incorporated. And it would be nice to say that we were not significantly beyond our proportions in the society. But again, that's not the case. If you look at the, can I call it the honor roll, of syndicate members between the Second World War, First World War, and the Second World War, you'll find that in absolute numbers, the Jews appear at all levels of gangsterism in almost identical number to the Italians. The mafia control of the syndicates is a post-World War II phenomenon. Some of you may remember the Kiefhofer investigations of the early 1950s. And if you remember those investigations, you remember that Jew after Jew after Jew, the Lanskys and the Lepkes and the Kleinmans were all brought before the Kiefhofer Committee. Jews were disproportionately involved in the emergence of the syndicates and the crime syndicates in the United States. Now, these thoughts were occasioned in my mind by the publication quite recently, a very interesting book, by a man named Alfred Fried, who is a professor of history at the State University of New York in Purchase, which he calls The Rise and Fall of the American Jewish Gangster. It's interesting for a variety of reasons, but I found it particularly interesting because he puts into a schema, a conceptual schema, the rise and the fall. He forces us to confront the social pathology which existed as part of Jewish life in our places of immigration and continues to a certain degree to exist among us. But he also speaks of the fall of the Jewish gangster, but not as much. That somehow after the Second World War, Jewish gangsters as leaders of the syndicate tend to disappear. There are a few who live on, the Dalitzes and the Lanskys, but they're old men. By and large, no new generation came to take over the place in the syndicate that had once been occupied by the preceding generation. And the question is why? And the answer goes back, I suppose, really to the original purpose of gangsterism, to emerge into the Golden Medina, to take advantage of all that America had to offer, to see America as a place of potential wealth and to go after that wealth and gain it. And so they tried to launder their money and they tried to launder their lives and they tried to guarantee that their children would go to private schools and to good American universities and be seen as part of the straight community rather than of their community. It was part of the pattern of upward mobility in the United States. I say this in no way to exonerate these people. They were predators. They were feral jungle creatures. Amoral, who committed many an unconscionable act. But I suggest to you that if we accept ourselves for what we are, contradictory and complex, if we accept the social order for what it is, a contrast again, a contradictory place of poverty, of wealth, of tension and of opportunity, then it's not surprising that some chose this road. And given prohibition, it's not surprising that gangsterism emerged into big business in the United States. And it's not surprising that once having achieved what they wanted to achieve, they've tried to pull back into the society that they wanted to join in the first place, but simply took a divergent way in order to achieve it. Nor should, would I say, suggest that we don't have our amoral, feral, predatory creatures still within the Jewish community. We do. Not very far from here. They deal with labor racketeering and extortion, misappropriation of funds from pension funds and the like. We've had, there are very few men who have made great, great wealth in the United States who've not in one way or another bribed or used protection or asked for protection or gambled with people whom they knew were not quite the kinds of people they would normally like to do business with. It's not surprising. And when the history of this generation is written, there will be those official histories which will speak of our Nobel Prize winners, of our fine research scientists and chemists, of our professors and rabbis and scholars and artists and musicians. And some rabbi 30 years from now will talk also about the auditors who managed to fudge the books and about the developers who managed to find ways to not build what they promised to build and so on and so forth. What's the moral of all of this? There are several, I think. The first is that when you're tempted next time to condemn those who are living in the impacted and impoverished ghettos of our cities for their crime, remember that but for the grace of several generations, there go you, or your children, or your brothers, or your sisters. The American society has always used part of its inner city as a way station into the larger society. And in these areas of first settlement, and the movement can be from overseas to America, or from the farms to the cities, or from the hills to the cities, wherever it comes, there's going to be crowding, social pathology, and crime, violence. And remember, too, that despite the nostalgia and the romantic nonsense that has been written about the Lower East Side of New York, yes, it was colorful. But despite the Irving Howells and the world of our fathers and that whole ethos which has developed among us, which looks back, you know, to our grandparents' generation as if it included things which we would well like to recapture. But the one thing that the people who lived in the Lower East Side wanted was to get out. And they worked day after day after day with only one thought in mind, to move to Harlem, to move to Brooklyn, to be able to leave. And the one thing that the city dweller today hopes for is to leave Huff, to leave Central, to leave the near West Side, to find a home with a little bit of grass and a little bit of security. As long as there is poverty, as long as there is immigration, internal or external, so long will crime be part of the urban scene as one society moves through its period of immigration into a period of acculturation and of belonging. When you're tempted to condemn the blacks or the hillbillies for the crime of Cleveland, perhaps let me give you a Xerox of an article which was written by Theodore Bingham, the police commissioner of the city of New York, who published an article in 1907 in the American Mercury, which was then one of the leading and most prestigious of the thoughtful journals, in which he spoke of the infestation by Hebrew criminals of New York City, of Jews of Russian descent who have come to our shores without any sense of family or morality, and who carry crime like a virus into the body politic of our fair city. Now, the language is early 20th century, not late 20th century, but transpose Jews for blacks, Jews for hillbillies, or Jews for Puerto Ricans, and you can have the same, you can find easily the same kind of vitriol in the public press and certainly in 1,000 private conversations. There's a second lesson, I believe, or rather a second problem. We're talking a great deal about the need to come back to the city, to make life livable in an urban environment. But I'm afraid you can't do two things at once. You can't use the city as a way station into America and at the same time expect to be able to impose upon the city stability and security and a what we would call a suburban kind of life. The two things are incompatible. Unless you do what is increasingly being done in America is to treat apartment complexes as the medievals treated their castles, as moats with mounted patrols. And you move from one moat protection to another castle and its protection in an armored car, locked doors, without being, you're in the city, but not of the city. I wonder how much how social thinkers 20 years from now are going to react to all of the conversation and planning which is going on, which talks about reestablishing the security of our cities, reestablishing urban life, reestablishing the Ohio cities, the downtown, in-town housing areas. You can do it, provided you don't bring in Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Dominicans, Haitians, provided you don't bring in Vietnamese and Laotians, provided you seal your borders, provided you allow a generation or two to complete the task of in-migration, acculturation, which the American Indian and the Black are now going through. In time, you'll be able to establish security in the center cities. But if we intend to remain, to have open borders and open doors, to be a land of refuge for many of the oppressed, then I doubt that we're going to be able to have our cake and eat it too. And maybe suburbia has to be rethought. Maybe it isn't that unfortunate post-World War II experiment that Americans assume now that it was. There has to be some kind of physical separation between two kinds of societies. One which knows how to live in a modern, complex environment, and one which is just beginning the process of learning. Now, I know that crime is mobile, but I also know that most crime in the impacted areas is black on black, that most crime is poor on poor. That's unfortunate. It's part of the price any new in-migrant generation pays before it emerges into the larger society. So I leave you with the thought, at least, that as long as other groups are passing through the gangster stage, the prostitution stage, passing through the in-migrant stage, so long are our cities going to contain areas like the Tenderloin, areas of violence, areas of crime, and as long also as we forget that this is a normal, natural, inevitable process which requires a generation to be, or at least to be gone through. As long as we forget that, we're going to be making great mistakes, I'm afraid, in planning for our future. The rise and fall of the Jewish gangster. Thank God he's fallen. May he stay dead. I'll be the first to say Kaddish over him. Amen.